Yeah, thanks, Daniel, for this interesting introduction. And finally, I know how I got to the US. And maybe that's why the NSA pays so much money for it. Okay, I will talk about quantum computing with trapped ions today. And you can see these experiments as thought experiments, and they're actually not thought experiments, they're experiments really being done in the lab, but they are really like the thought experiments, the fathers of quantum mechanics, what they use to really understand quantum mechanics or some aspects of quantum mechanics in maybe a little bit better. I will begin my presentation with talking about a relationship between physics and information, and then switch to a particular implementation of quantum information processing, namely with trapped ions. Talk then about the quantum teleportation algorithm, which we basically developed with Daniel. And then finally, I conclude by giving you some perspective where this field actually could go. So I want to start with this statement by Rolf Landauer, who said that information is physical. So what does it mean, information is physical? Well, what he thought is that if you have information, you have to think about some physical implementation. Just information is meaningless. And if you follow this principle, it means if you want to delete information, that you need to generate entropy. So that, in other words, it means if you delete the memory in your computer, you generate something, heat, essentially. But there's also another way of what happens, a relationship between physics and information. Consider a physical process here, okay, a pretty violent one, but we as physicists all believe that we can capture the essentials of this by actually performing some computation. You transform information into some other information, you do this with an algorithm. So that means that physics is also somehow information, so the conjecture is that actually the same thing? Is physics the same thing as information? You can speculate about this, but if we take this statement like of Rolf Landauer, information is physical, and physics means quantum mechanical, it's sort of natural that information should be not classical, but also quantum mechanical. And of course, we retrieve what we call classical information simply as a subset then as from quantum information. So that is my motivation why maybe it's interesting to look at quantum information. And quantum information is really like you try to be as abstract as possible. You take quantum mechanics and you get rid of all these complications like the electron spin, what is the spin of an electron, and so forth. You just say, I have a Hilbert space. My electron spin is described in this Hilbert space. I have unitary operations which transform the state in the Hilbert space. And of course, as a physicist, I would like to know what's going on, so I add the measurement. And that's essentially what quantum information is about, these three pieces. You want to have, of course, a basic unit of quantum information. It's called a qubit. And a qubit can be, for instance, an atom being the ground state, that would be one state, or the one would correspond to the atom in an excited state. And of course, since it's a quantum mechanical system, we have also superpositions possible where the electron really doesn't know where it is. And there's this nice picture you might have come across. It's the so-called Bloch sphere picture where you can identify, for instance, the zero state with the Bloch vector pointing up, and the one with the Bloch vector pointing down, and those superpositions correspond then to the Bloch vector pointing in some other, more or less arbitrary direction. The power of quantum information is not actually if you have just one qubit, it comes really when you try to combine qubits, or when you start combining qubits. I've written here the most general state of a three-qubit register, and you see that you need 8 complex numbers to describe this state, the most general state of a three-qubit register. To show you where this actually leads to is, I've put here examples of this. So here this would be an example of this state. Classically, we just need 3 binary numbers, but quantum mechanically, we need 8 continuous numbers. And if I add 1 qubit, I get more and more numbers to write down. And for 8 qubits, I need quite a number of numbers to actually specify my general quantum state. And the situation becomes really ridiculous if you, for instance, look at 40 qubits to describe a general state which corresponds to a 40-qubit register with a reasonable accuracy. You need already memory of 10,000 gigabyte. If you add 1 more qubit, you have to double the memory. And this means really that classical computers right now have no way of even storing this state vector corresponding to 40 qubits. If you have 300 qubits, we would need to store one in each atom in the universe, one classical bit. So it becomes really ridiculous there. And that's why quantum information at least has the potential to be much, much more powerful than classical information. Suppose, for instance, the following problem. You are somehow interested in solving the Schrödinger equation for 300 interacting spins in a very general way. If you're not able to do specific tricks, your classical computation needs actually more bits than there are atoms in the universe. So then clearly this is an impossible task. But a quantum computer, on the other hand, just needs 300 qubits. And you just need to implement those interactions between the spins. And therefore, quantum computers potentially can solve certain tasks much, much, much more efficiently than classical computers will ever be able to do. There are other prominent examples which actually are, from the financial point of view, more interesting. Factoring of large numbers. The US spy business is interested in this. And this is actually where the field started to take off by the invention of the factoring algorithm by Peter Shor, 1994. And also, unsorted databases can be searched much more efficiently using quantum information processing tools. So that is the motivation why we should care about quantum information. How does a quantum computer work? I want to give you a feeling for that with some analogy. Think about a classical computer. You first initialize your register. Then you do some operations. The NAND gate actually can be shown that you can implement any algorithm just with NAND gates. You work on like your states. Here, the bits have specific states. In the end, you're going to read out the result. A quantum computer works, at least in the simplest case, very similar. You initialize your quantum register. You perform some operations on the register. It turns out that here we need single qubit operations and what we call 2-qubit gates, where the 2 qubits interact with each other. We work on a Hilbert space instead of this very classical space, which is 2 to the n dimensional, as I just pointed out. And in the end, we read out the information. Note that this here is completely classical. We initialize in a very well-defined quantum state, and here we gain also classical information. All the quantum magic is happening here when we do the actual operations. Another view of it, we take the states of a quantum register, make some unitary operation, and end up with a different state. And I put this here to show you, to illustrate to you, we need these just these 2 different building blocks, single qubit operations, which just act on one line. This represents 1 qubit here. And these interactions, this is a specific 2-qubit gate, a so-called controlled NOT gate. I will talk later more about what it actually does, which actually leads to conditional operations. And the interesting thing is that any unitary operation you can come up with, you can implement just with a series of these 2 different types of gates. And those are then the building blocks for a quantum computer. When you can do this operation and that operation, you can do anything you like to. Okay, so Suppose our long-term goal, or our goal, is now to build a universal quantum computer, that is a quantum computer which can run any quantum algorithm. This is a very, very difficult goal, simply very difficult, and we as physicists have actually a slightly different interest, I would say, at least for myself. I'm mainly doing this work because I want to get a little bit more understanding about quantum mechanics. I also want to see applications of quantum mechanics. That's what quantum computation is about, after all, but maybe we can see before that quantum applications. And also, it's interesting to look whether quantum mechanics might actually fail. If we can't build a universal quantum computer, we may be able to find out why we can't, and then we see maybe that quantum mechanics actually failed. And actually, there's no reason to believe that quantum mechanics is correct. So far, almost every theory in the history of physics has failed at some point. So why not quantum mechanics? So there are many different possibilities to build a quantum computer. I want to point out a few of those. You can store photons in cavities and use the photons as carriers of quantum information. You can actually use also photons. You can encode the quantum information in the spins of nuclei. You can encode quantum information in electrons trapped in quantum dots, or you can use superconducting circuits. I want to concentrate here on the trapped atom ion approach, so here on really trapped ions, but also with neutral atoms, similar techniques can be done. So let's concentrate here simply on trapped ions. This is the basic view, what Ignacio Sirac and Peter Zoller had in mind 1995, how a quantum computer could look like, and that was actually the first proposal of a quantum computer. The idea is to store a string of ions. Each ion will represent a quantum bit. With the help of electromagnetic forces, which are applied with those electrodes here, you can see those four plates plus the end caps, apply voltages on here, and you can trap such a string of here, I guess it's 7 or 8 ions. And the idea is to manipulate them with lasers. And we'll go now with you through the steps which we need to do such a quantum calculation. At first, so this looks really easy, right? And this is here is half of the experiment. It's not the full experiment, but the physics is happening here in this vacuum chamber, and later on I will show you some simplifications. Where this is the trap, and here this is in the vacuum chamber so that the qubits don't interact with the environment. And in this trap, we trap, for instance, the ions, and you can see here a picture taken with a CCD camera from three ions fluorescing while we shine in laser radiation. Each of these ions represents a qubit, and this is the level scheme of the calcium 40 plus ions, the calcium ions. It's calcium 40, and they're singly ionized. And this is the level scheme. The fluorescence you see here comes from this transition where we excited here on the laser with 397 nanometers, and when a photon falls down, we simply can collect that on a CCD camera. The qubit are actually the two levels, the S1 half and the D5 half level. The D5 half level, this transition, you have to change angular momentum by 2h bar, and that means it's a forbidden transition, and that means that this lifetime of this state here is reasonable. It's about a second. That means that we can, in principle, keep quantum information in the system for about 1 second, which for the moment is more than enough. So each ion represents one qubit. So let's do something with it. So the first step, what we have seen, is that we want to initialize our qubit. It's fairly easy. So we don't know whether the qubit is in this state or in this state. Okay, let's shine in laser light on this transition, D5 half, P1 half. Okay, actually it goes up here, but nevertheless, the basic principle is correct. And then it will decay down, and then at the end, all the population will be collected here. If it falls down here, no problem. We keep this laser on for some time, and eventually all the population will be collected down here. So the initialization is really straightforward. Then we want to do the computation. We shine in a strong laser field on the S1 half D5 half transition. And in this way, we promote the electrons from here up here, or from the D5 half down to the S1 half. Those are our single qubit operations, as we will see in a moment. And finally, we will read out. We simply apply laser light on the S1 half P1 half level. If we see fluorescence, the ion has been projected into this state. And you can imagine what happens if the ion is projected into this state, then this laser doesn't couple. We don't see any fluorescence. And you can see here the corresponding CCD image is black. For two ions, this works also. You can here see examples, two ions fluorescing. So the quantum state is SS, the left ion fluorescence, SD, DS, and if both are dark, we are in the DD state. We repeat those experiments over and over to gain statistics, and that's our basic measurement principle. And we are ready now to do the first experiment. We initialize in the S state. We shine in laser light for some time, which is here on this axis, to promote the electron to the D5 half state. And in the end, we measure. And for each point, we repeat the procedure 200 times. And then we put there the probability to find the ion in the D state. And what you can see is that the ion is excited into the D state, and then it's de-excited. And these are so-called Rabi oscillations. And on a Bloch sphere picture, you can visualize it as follows. So when you go here, the Bloch vector would be turned over here. And then if you shine in laser light for about 400 nanoseconds in this example, the Bloch vector would point completely upwards. So this is like, already a good start. So we have seen how to initialize our quantum register. We have actually seen how to do single qubit operations. Those are Rabi oscillations, simply. I haven't said anything about the two qubit gates, because that's the tricky bit. And in the end, we need to read out our qubits and gain the classical information. So the rest of the talk, or almost the rest of the talk, I will deal now with this problem here. So how do we get the qubits interact with each other? That's the tricky bit. And for this, we use actually the motion of the ion string. If we push on one ion, the ions are positively charged. They repel each other, but they are coupled via the Coulomb interaction. And you get then normal modes. And you can see here a normal mode excited of a probably 7-ion string, where the ions all move together. And this will be the key to understand how the ions will interact with each other. You kick one ion, and it will kick the other ion. And in this way, one ion can feel whether the other ion was kicked or not. And that's the idea. We describe the system, of course, quantum mechanically, because we want to do we do quantum physics. So we have we approximate our ion as a two-level atom, seen here, S or D level, separated by a transition frequency omega naught. And then we have a harmonic oscillator of the trap. We just look at the so-called center of mass mode, so we deal just with one harmonic oscillator. We arrive then at this level scheme. In this direction, we have energy. And then you can plot here these states. Here you have the harmonic oscillator ladder, 0, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2. And here we have the electronic states. Now we can shine in laser radiation, coupling those levels. And that's the trick. So we can, for instance, shine in what we call the red sideband, where the D0 state gets de-excited to the S state, but we create one phonon. Maybe more easy is to understand what's happening on the blue sideband. We offer the atom just too much energy, so much energy that it can flip its electronic state and also change its motional excitation by one. And these are the basic operations which we are going to use from now on. Okay, so let's entangle two ions. This is a proposal by 1999 by Klaus Möllmann and Anders Sørensen. and was realized shortly afterwards by the Vineland group in Boulder. What do we do? We have two ions in the trap, and I have now the level scheme of two ions in the trap. So we have ions, both ions in the ground state, and also the motion is in the ground state. We have both ions in the D state, but the motion is in the ground state. And here we have this intermediate level where one ion is excited, the other is in the ground state, and we have either zero or one motional quantum. We shine in now two laser beams on both ions at the same time, a blue field and a red field. And what you can see here is that the frequencies are chosen that such that the blue photon plus a red photon fill exactly this energy gap, but not this intermediate step. And what that means is, if you shine in that laser field, that the ion string can undergo this global transition from SS to DD, but in here, energy conservation actually forbids us to populate these levels here. But we use the motion here to have the ions talk to each other. And that this actually works here, I can show you here as a plot. This is the length of this pulse which we use here. And we record here the state population, for instance, of the SS state. So we start off with 100% in the SS state. It falls. And at the same time, we get population into the D state. That's exactly what we expected here. Since our detuning is here not very big, we intermediately populate those red points, and those are here this level, the DS1 level. But the parameters are carefully chosen such that this population vanishes here, and at this point we have a 50-50 probability to find either the SS or the DD state. And the big question now is this what we call an entangled state? Are those two atoms now correlated? And that's exactly our goal, to have those atoms either both in the SS state or both in the DD, but we don't know which. For this, also Daniel James played a major role in developing this technique, is we need to find out whether there's a coherent superposition of SS and DD. When we do a detection, we either find both ions for this state fluorescing or not. So that's relatively straightforward. But what's not straightforward is to find out whether it's a coherent superposition or an incoherent mixture. And also, what is the relative phase of the superposition? Is this here a minus or is this a plus? And there's a technique which is called quantum state tomography, with which you can actually measure the density matrix. So this is the density matrix corresponding to this state here, and you can measure it. I can maybe talk a little bit later about it, but here, unfortunately, I don't have time to do so. So this is what we do here, and in order to test this hypothesis that there's a coherent superposition, we shine in laser light to let those two parts interfere with each other. So we do essentially an interference experiment. And if we do so and change the phase of this light field, we see really interference fringes as what you can see here. And those interference fringes are the signature that those two states are actually coherent with each other. And yeah, when you do so from the contrast, you can actually estimate the degree of coherence. And from that, you can determine what's called the state fidelity of this state. So how well we produce actually this state. And when you do so, calculate that, that means that in 99.3% of the cases, we actually prepared this state. And that's actually quite a good number. So you can actually generalize this. So this is for two ions. This is the level scheme now for four ions. And we do exactly the same thing, but now many things can happen at the same time, and indeed they do, at least if you believe basic quantum mechanics. And if you do the calculation, you will find that you would end with a state which looks like this. And we've done the experiment. And we have done the check whether those states, so we find indeed that either all ions are in the ground state or all ions are in the excited state. And we have checked for the interference capability. And this is the corresponding interference fringes. Now you can see instead of two interference fringes in the range of minus pi to pi, we see now four. We have four ions. We have four times the energy spacing of a single atom. And that's why the signal oscillates four times as fast. This is the entangling pulse, and this is the analysis pulse here, where we scan the phase of this pulse. So we can even go further. Here are six ions which are entangled, and here there are eight ions which we have entangled with this method, and that's where actually the people who are involved in this particular experiment. So what is so significant about this 8-ion GHC state? Well, you can actually see it as a Schrödinger cat. So we have created this state. All ions are in the S state plus all ions are in the D state. And you can assume that the 7 qubits here correspond to a cat alive, and those 7 would correspond to D, like dead. And this is really like now we have produced a Schrödinger cat. But it's... The most, that's tricky. Because then, yes, exactly. And that's why you need this other operation. So this is a very special thing. You essentially need to concatenate those C knots. And it boils down to the fact how well you can do so this operation. And if you have to apply this operation 20 times, you lose each time 1%, then you have only 80% fidelity. But that's, so for 4 qubits, I'm fairly confident that you can produce any state you want to. But for more, it's, that's how it becomes, why we have this. What I plot here is now the fidelity as a function of the number of ions. And you can see the more ions we put in there, the less good the operation is. And I should point out that we don't really understand why the fidelity seems to drop quadratically. We would expect it actually to drop linearly because like the involved physical processes. So there is something which we have to understand in terms of the decoherence processes there. Okay, with that, I want to move on and talk a little bit about teleportation, the teleportation experiment, which comes actually more to your question, how do we do more general or more complicated operations? But first, I want to introduce you what a physicist understands or some physicists think is teleportation about. So the idea is that you have two parties, A and B, and what we do is that we give party A a state, and party A does not know what this state is, but we ask party A to transmit this state to Bob. But Bob and Alice are really far away from each other, so there's not a good way of actually carrying that state over there. So this is our problem. So for instance, Bob is on the moon, Alice is here, and it's difficult to send a qubit up there. So what can you do? So we allow only classical communication, and we want Psi to show up at Bob's place. So what would you do? Okay, you take the input state, you look at it, you find out maybe some information about it, and you send this information over to Bob. But due to the projection principle, you project the state, you destroy the state, you can't look repeatedly at it, and so forth. It turns out that you can do that only with a fidelity of 66.6%. And therefore, this procedure does not work simply. So we have to think about something slightly differently, and that is what's called quantum teleportation. We start with an additional resource, and this resource is actually a Bell state. So what we do is, for instance, Alice and Bob might have been in the past at the same place, They share a Bell state. Bob, when he flies to the moon, takes his part of the Bell pair, like this entangled state, with him. And now he's sitting on the moon. And we ask now Alice, can you transfer this quantum state? Bob needs it really urgently up to Bob. What Alice can do now is she can do what's called a Bell state measurement. That's a measurement in a different basis, a measurement in the so-called Bell basis. And she learns now two classical bits of information because she measures essentially two bits. And she transmits those two bits. And then Bob, taking his part of the Bell pair, does a rotation. And mystery or not, by magic, somehow retrieves the original state over here. And that's the so-called teleportation protocol. So it's a transfer of quantum information between two places by means of classical communication and previously sharing some quantum resource. This is the quantum circuit, here for developed by us for the teleportation sequence. We have two qubits, which we have like Alice has, and one qubit, which Bob has. We start out by sharing entanglement between qubit number 2 and 3. And we know how to do this. This is here the density matrix of a Bell state. This can be done, for instance, with this global interaction I talked about a few minutes ago. This is the corresponding density matrix which we measured. Then we write in the arbitrary quantum state over here using Rabi oscillations, essentially. And then we have to do the Bell state measurement. And that's the tricky bit. The Bell state measurement consists here out of a sequence. This is the so-called controlled NOT gate. This dot here represents that we will do this NOT, this cross, here, depending on whether this qubit is 0 or 1. And rotate the quantum state by pi over 2 around a particular axis, measure it, and depending on this, we will rotate the state of Bob. So the trick is to do this Bell state measurement, and this little piece here is a quantum circuit which actually is supposed to do our rotation into the so-called Bell basis. On the left side, I've written here the Bell basis. Those are 4 entangled states. We have seen this state already. Then you can have the state with the minus sign, and you can have also those anti-correlated qubits. And this quantum circuit is supposed to map it over here, and we will see in a minute how this works. And this is the logical eigenbasis, and that's actually our measurement procedure does distinguish those states. And if we take an arbitrary state, rotate with this sequence and measure in this basis, we have effectively done a measurement in this basis over here. What we need for this is the so-called controlled knot, and that's the key to almost all quantum information processing ideas. What is a controlled knot? Okay, I should actually say that this publication here in 1995 by Ignacio and Peter was the starting point for quantum information, at least experimental quantum information, where they made this proposal how to do a controlled knot for trapped ions. So what does a controlled knot gate do? It takes two qubits and maps them to two qubits. If the first bit, which is called the control bit, is 0, nothing happens to the target bit. However, if it's 1, the target bit is flipped. You can see here the target bit goes from 0 to 1 and here from 1 to 0. That's what our control knot is supposed to do. We have implemented that with the tools I have shown you. It's a particular pulse sequence I don't have time to go into. And here you can see the truth table of this. This is the likelihood that if we go in with 0, 0, we end up with 0, 0, and only very little goes to 0, 1, or 1, 0, or 1, 1. And if we go, for instance, in with 1, 1, we come out with 1, 0, and you can see this really fulfills this condition to a large degree. So this is the truth table of a C0, but something more interesting happens if we don't look really at the truth table. Okay, I should say that this controlled not allows us then to generate arbitrary states in principle. So it becomes really interesting to see not if you look, for instance, at this sequence. So first, we start, of course, for instance, with the ion string initialized in the SS state. We bring in now the first qubit in a superposition, which is the control bit of S and D. And now we apply the C naught. What's going to happen? If the first qubit is in S, the target bit is not flipped. But if it's in D, the target bit is supposed to flip. So we have generated a Bell state. And that's actually, so we have generated entanglement using this sequence. How this works in practice is actually shown here. What I plot here is, as time goes on, the probability to find the ion string either both fluorescing, the left one fluorescing, the right one fluorescing, or both are dark. And those shaded areas mark different pulses where we apply different frequencies at different ions to the ion string. And you can follow here the populations, and you can see here it's a pi over 2 pulse on the control ion. We create the state SS plus DS. And that's this first step. That's really easy. And all the effort goes into doing this C naught. It's lots of pulses. I think it's 7 pulses or so. But at the end, and that's the interesting thing, is what comes out is either both ions are fluorescing or both ions are dark, and that looks like a Bell state. And that's what we actually expect from this sequence. And for our Bell state measurement, all what we have to do is we have to turn it around, right? It's a unitary operation. So we turn it around. We start with our Bell state, SS plus DD, go in here and end up with SS. So it's really that straightforward. And that, because it's a unitary operation and each partial operation is a unitary operation, you just need to rearrange it. There's no difficult math involved in making the inverse. Okay, now we are set. Bell state preparation, preparation of the state, controlled knot, measurement in the Bell basis. So this whole block is the effective measurement in the Bell basis, controlled operations. And finally, we can check whether we produce this state again with single qubit operations. So we have tested the procedure not for all input states, but only for 6 selected input states, either in the S state, the D state, or the 4 various superpositions. And of course, the protocol doesn't work with 100% fidelity. There are measurement implementation errors. But the important thing is, this is what you could achieve with the method I presented to you first, like the sort of classical method, measure 1 qubit and transfer the information you retrieved about it. And this is the fidelity with which we could do the state transfer. Okay, so this, I should point out, it's kind of old, but it illustrates nicely all the tools what you need for quantum information processing, and the more recent stuff is actually much more complicated, maybe not so, would require more time. So now we have all the tools together. We have now the 2 qubit gates, the controlled knot gate, and with all these tools, you can, in principle, do any arbitrary quantum, any quantum algorithm you would like to. The only problem is that the fidelity of the operations is not 100%, and that's actually one problem. And another problem is the more ions you have in the string, the less perfect the operations are, and that's the so-called scaling problem, and I will spend in a few slides on that as well. But let's first look again at the hardware, and when you look at that, you can see that it scales really okay. I hate this. So this is where we stand now. This is what the ENIAC 1950 looked like. So we are still worse off than this. But in the meantime, this picture was taken 2004. In the meantime, we have moved closer to this stage simply by putting a box around it. But this box has a good use. This box is a magnetic shielding, so it's a mu metal and aluminum to shield magnetic fields which cause decoherence. So this improves the lifetime of our qubits by almost an order of magnitude. So it's a good investment. So there is a reason. Okay, but let's come now more to how to scale ion-trapped quantum computers. And the main problem is that the more ions I have in the ion string, the more complicated things can happen and the more chances there are that I will screw up my computation. And for that reason, Dave Vineland, Dave Kilpinski, and Chris Monroe thought about the following. They thought, well, let's split up the ion string in smaller pieces and shuttle the ions around and have them then interact only in pairs, where the situation is much more easily to control. Another way to break up the problem is having, in the first place, only one ion and couple them via photons. So an ion might here emit a photon, which is coupled via a high-finesse resonator into a fiber, transmitted over there, caught by the next ion, and this way you can have also a quantum link. Or you can also imagine this system. You have two ions. One ion is oscillating, inducing an image current, which is then picked up by the other ion. And those are three methods how one can think about scaling the ion trap approach a little bit better. Let's first look on this. This is the idea pioneered then experimentally by Didi Leibfried and Dave Vineland. And the idea is to have a dedicated memory region and a processor unit. And then by applying voltages here, you can actually move the ions over there, right? You apply a negative voltage here, a positive over here, and the ion string will move over here. And recently they have shown that you can actually pull out ions from that ion string, put them here, pull out the next one, then you have two ions here. You shine in laser light, you do the interaction just on two ions, and here they can sit hundreds of thousands of ions, and they don't talk to these two ions. And I do my C0 over here, and then I move them back into the memory. So one thing you might wonder, whether the quantum information basically survives moving the ions around, and there's a recent publication by the NIST group which actually shows shuttling of the ions in this trap here, from over here, for instance, over here, and then back. And what they have shown is with an interference experiment that even though they transported the information, the interference contrast stayed constant, whether they transported or not. And that means that during the transport, there is, at least due to the transport, no loss of coherence. And that's quite good for this approach, because if you would lose the quantum information when you transport your ion, that would obviously be a really bad idea. Okay, so this approach looks quite good, and I believe that's actually the way people will work in the next 5 or 10 years. Another idea which I pursue now in Berkeley is the following. Suppose you have two ions in two independent traps, and just how would you connect ions? Well, let's put just a wire in between. If an ion moves here, it will induce an image current. That image current creates a voltage over here. That voltage talks to this ion. And you can analyze the system, and you find remarkable things. If you believe at least quantum mechanics, this quantum state transfer should even work at 300 Kelvin, which is for many physicists really surprising, that you squeeze in quantum information into the hot wire. It's really a violent environment and should come out at the other side, but that's what the calculations say. And so, yeah, one requirement is, of course, that no trace of the quantum information should remain in the wire. Otherwise, I've done a measurement. And that's why many people argue that you need a superconducting wire, but calculations show that you actually don't, and it will be quite interesting to verify whether this is really true or what else we miss here in physics. And yeah, this is the setup, like a sketch of the setup. And This is the trap we are using. It's a surface trap. It's really easy to fabricate. It's just gold patterned onto a substrate. And you can see here an iron string trapped about 200 micron above the surface. With this, I want to conclude. So I talked about ion trap quantum computing. I showed you the recent experiments where we have generated an 8-ion GHD state, trying to understand the decoherence mechanisms. And this can be viewed also as a Schrödinger kitten. It's really a small one, like a Schrödinger embryo, probably. I should have. I showed you how you can implement teleportation, the teleportation protocol. I should point out that this was the first deterministic teleportation. With photons, teleportation has been done across a couple of kilometers, even I think 100 kilometers now, but it was never deterministic. Here in this case, it's deterministic. However, the downside is the distance was only 10 micron. But Chris Monroe recently has done also an indeterministic protocol with trapped ions over a meter, but this was again indeterministic. So, and I gave you some ideas how one could scale up the ion trap quantum information approach. Okay, with this, I want to thank you for your attention.